This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Realized I had not put the recording button on. I don't want to bring you through that misery.
I've done that before. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good day, everybody. This is yet another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm again delighted to have a very good friend and colleague of our CWS Incubation Lab, Chris Dorsey, and he will actually, like usual, he will introduce himself and tell a little bit about himself as well. So Chris, please go ahead.
Thank you, Maurice. I am glad to be here, and thank you for the invitation to be a part of this this podcast and the program. My name, as you said, is Chris Dorsey, and I work as the President of Higher Education and Leadership Ministries for the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. It's a mainline Protestant denomination here in the U.S. and Canada, and in my role in particular, because I work with higher education, I interact with all of our 15 colleges and universities, our 7 theological institutions. I run a couple of leadership development programs for college students and young adults, and I work to develop programming and support infrastructure for education and leadership development across the church.
Thanks, Chris. And can you tell a little bit on how did you get involved in this work? You know, why are you walking the path that you're walking now?
Yeah, very good question. So since my days in seminary, I didn't necessarily see myself as being a local pastor, although I have pastored churches a couple of times. I saw that most of my ministry, most of my work would be in the area of higher education and supporting young adults. So I've had other positions as a college chaplain. I've also worked as a seminary professor. And so I've done a lot, but it's usually been in the area of higher education and leadership development. And so when the position came open to be president of higher education, I was encouraged by the board and the search committee to apply for the position. And it just seemed like a really good fit based on everything that I have done before in my career and my ministry in terms of working with higher education. It just seemed like a really good fit for my particular skills, especially the leadership development portion.
Mm-hmm. If you look back at the expectations that you had when you started, is it indeed providing you with what you were expecting? And so do you feel at home? Do you feel at the right spot where you are?
I do. I think we all have those moments when we take a job and we have a certain amount of idealism about all the great things that the job entails and the wonderful parts of the job that we're attracted to. And I certainly have that. But then we also have those moments where we realize that it's heavy on administrative responsibilities. And so those are the things that we do, I think, to earn the paycheck. And everything else is the more enjoyable part. But there's certainly a lot of enjoyable parts to what I do, and it still is very much what I had hoped it would be.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that part of the job is also your interaction with students, younger students. I'm assuming, As I mentioned to many folks that I had invited to do this virtual walk with me, you know, very often we end up talking about purpose in life and religion, spirituality, and then it somehow quickly goes about, you know, the young generation that looks differently at religion and spirituality, according to some. Others say no. So I would like to hear your kind of observation or reflections on this younger generation, which is, of course, you cannot, you know, consider this as one group. It's because it's also diverse and, you know, different generations, different backgrounds. But in general, as you know, do you see a different type of trend with the younger generation with regard to spirituality, religion, and the way they look at life and what they find important? I know it's a loaded question and it's, yeah, it's huge, but still, give yeah, it a go.
It's a good question. I mean, for all the reasons that you stated, it's always challenging to try and identify an overarching way of thinking or believing or understanding any one group. But I definitely think there are some trends and maybe some influences that are shaping the way emerging adults are thinking about things like faith and spirituality. And so on the one hand, there are definitely those trends and those influences. And then it also is a matter of where they're coming from themselves and what sector of society they are a part of. If they're part of an urban environment, if they're part of rural environments or grew up in rural areas, depending on the racial, ethnic, and cultural background that they come out of, a lot of these things too also influence the way young people think about faith and spirituality. I think that, and to some extent, there was a time, I think, when people were pushing more toward this idea of being spiritual and not religious. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear that much about that anymore, although I suspect some of it is out there. I think what I see more now are people are interested in belonging to communities that are making a difference in the world. And that's how they understand the connection between the faith that they may be a mm-hmm. part of or that they may participate in, and what it means to be a part of a church or any sort of faith organization. And so I think that seems to be guiding young people more than a name or a tradition or even a belief system. Mm. I think what they're more interested in now, or that a lot of the young people that I deal with, is they're interested in making a difference, and having an impact on the world, and how are the communities that they're a part of helping them to do that? And I think that's pulling them toward faith communities in very specific ways, perhaps more so than any doctrine or beliefs or traditions might do.
And when you're talking about lately, is that for the last couple of years or is it since the start of this pandemic?
Oh, it's definitely within the last few years. Okay. Yeah. Even before the pandemic, mm-hmm. what I'd noticed in working with young people, they're really motivated by wanting to make a difference and whether or not their communities, their faith-based communities, are doing just that. Mm-hmm. The songs that they sing, you know, people think, oh, well, young people just want, you know, energetic worship experiences or something like that. And it may be nice to have those things, but I think especially the young people that I work with in colleges, they're mm-hmm. interested in whether or not the faith communities that they are a part of are doing meaningful work to make a difference in the world. That's really what it comes down to. And I think that predated the pandemic by okay. at least a couple mm. of years in terms of what I've been seeing.
And did it require certain changes from your side as a teacher, as a faith leader, as a, you know, as a president of your institute?
Yeah, so I think with one of the main programs that I run is called the Leadership Fellows Program for our denomination, and it works with college students during their time in college to help them as emerging leaders think through themes like community, social transformation, global awareness, and mentoring. Those are the four themes that we cover. You know, to answer your question more specifically, I think what we have done is we've tried to make sure that young people understand their role in having an impact on their faith communities. So if they're looking for a faith community that is making a difference in the world, what are they going to bring to that faith community to push it in that direction? So those are the kinds of things that I've done in terms of changing our program, is helping them not just to go looking for places where they can make a difference, but how do they influence organizations to make a difference. So that's one of the things that's changed, because I'm always cautious with young people, or anyone for that matter, who are looking for something in a Christian community or in a church. And I'm trying to encourage them or challenge them to think about their role in making those shifts, as opposed to just going somewhere else to find what they're looking for.
What I also kind of heard is that maybe, you know, it's not the religion or spirituality per se, but it is how church as an institution or as a building is perceived as well, which is different. I don't want to say less important, but it has a different meaning for young folks. Is that something that you see or
Yeah, I think so. And it's almost like we're coming full circle to some extent. If you look at the history of Protestant Christianity, in particular in North America, going all the way back to the first and the second Great Awakenings, especially during the second Great Awakening, many churches and Christians saw their role as being primarily about moving society forward, changing society, addressing the needs of those who were struggling. And that's always been there in American churches. But I think over the latter part of the 1800s and certainly throughout the 1900s, churches became more focused on just their institutional life itself, what it meant to build these grand buildings and to be the kind of church that people wanted to have their weddings and to have their kids baptized in. And so the overall trajectory of the American church was on building these grand institutions. And I think we've come out of that phase, especially as churches began to struggle in the last part of the 20th century and the early 21st century. They're going through a bit of an identity crisis. And I think young people are leading that. They're leading and pushing churches to sort of reclaim this notion that the church really is about social transformation. It really is about tending to the needs of people. And so I think that's what young people are moving into, is a period, because the church has gone through this identity crisis, then I think young people have a profound opportunity to reshape what church will be for the next 50 years. And so I think that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing churches begin to move back in that direction, and younger people are a part of that push.
Okay. Are the young people part of it, or are they leading it?
I always tell people that they're part of something, whether I describe the young people that I work with as emerging leaders, because I think that they are in a position of they're already to some extent leaders, but they may not be in official capacity as leaders. And so I describe them as emerging leaders because there may not be the specific space in the institutional life to describe them as official leaders. So I think they're participating in it along with other leaders. They're not the leaders, the only leaders of this process. I think they're part of the leadership. So to that extent, to answer your question, I think they're helping to lead it. I wouldn't say that they are the only ones. They're the only ones leading it. What I often describe in any kind of church or faith-based community, I tell people there's always a need to coalesce. And what I mean by coalesce is you need to be able to make room for emerging views while at the same time maintain the relevancy to those who have gone before. And so to that extent, it's not necessarily replacing or completely doing away with what had been there before. It's kind of a rearranging and a recoalescing, if you will. And I think that's what young people are contributing to, this recoalescing around what it means to be church and what it means to be the community of Christ. Mm-hmm.
Some of the topics that makes them, that drives them, what they're looking for, they would like to solve or contribute towards the solution, bringing a solution.
Yeah, I certainly think that access to resources is a big one, and that comes or that appears in a variety of different ways. So issues, we live in a world where there's a profound amount of disparity that exists in terms of income levels, in terms of access to education, in terms of healthcare. There's just a plethora of disparities that exist across society in so many ways. And I think our higher education institutions have done a pretty good job over the last 20 years of highlighting this. That's not to say that they've done a good job of addressing it, but I certainly think our colleges and universities have done a good job of highlighting these kinds of disparities. And so to that extent, I think young people are drawn to, or young people see the opportunity to address the profound lack and the unevenness in terms of access to resources. So things like water, we're now looking at what it means to maintain a planet with limited water resources. And we say that it's limited, but it really isn't as limited as we think. It really is just unevenly distributed. And so I think that's one of the issues that young people are drawn to, is what it means to make sure that people have access to basic resources. I certainly think race is an issue that young people are now increasingly aware of and drawn to. It's always been a problem. It's always been a challenge. But the way racism plays a role in these kinds of issues of disparity and lack are things that young people are increasingly more in tune to. And even as they become more diverse themselves, we have an increasingly diverse way of thinking about ethnicity, where lots of younger people may not necessarily see themselves as only African American or only white or only Latinx. They're oftentimes from mixed families. And so they're trying to help society, I think, to some extent, not ignore race, but deal with the legacy of racism, while also recognizing that in terms of racial identities, we're moving in different directions than we ever have before. We have a large number of students who are DACA enrollees and who were brought to this, brought to the country, you know, by parents who didn't have the proper documentation, and they have grown up in an environment where they have had to live pretty much their entire lives under the fear of being sent to a country that they would not have recognized or not really understood how to survive in. And so we do have a large number mm-hmm. of students who come from other countries, but our primary population would be persons who are citizens. Mm-hmm.
You know, you know why I am organizing these podcasts and why I'm walking this 100 mile. You know, is to raise awareness around hunger and poverty and other related issues. When you would be asked to walk 100 mile in a week, why would you? For what cause or for what reason would you walk 100 mile?
I think there's probably two things that motivate me, perhaps more than anything else these days. One is the issue of access to clean and potable water. And so a program that is expanding efforts to make water accessible to more people. In developing countries, certainly would be something that would motivate me. The second thing would probably be the plight of children, especially who are refugees. Refugee populations in general are ones that get my attention and certainly pull my heart to a great extent. But children in particular, who are often pulled into these situations without really understanding the full scope of what they're even being pulled into, being forced to leave their homes under the threat of violence and even natural disasters, and to be a child in that situation is it's heart-wrenching to think about. So those are probably the two things that would motivate me to do a 100-mile walk is trying to address those needs.
Yeah, I also resonate with both of these issues. I mean, water is, you know, the reason that we kind of came up with the Crop Hunger Walks within my organization is, you know, it is related with often women or girls who have to walk miles and miles to fetch water and, you know, to ensure that they can water the home gardens, etc. So that's so related with hunger and poverty issues, access to water and clean water. So you're so right, and kids, that children have a disadvantage already from birth because you know their mother did not eat the right food during pregnancy, or the child did not get the right food in the first 1,000 days, which is then, you know, irreversible. And you know it's relatively simple to do something about that. You know it's about political will and a little bit of effort of people involved.
And you know one of the issues, and I think you're hinting at a bit is what it means to as a child to struggle through a formative period of life where your life is not stable. So you think about the refugee populations and they start on a journey and it doesn't end in a couple of months. Oftentimes the journey of a refugee could be 5 to 10 years of trying to go from one place to another, trying to get settled, trying to find some sort of permanent life. And if you just imagine 5 years of a child's life without education or without adequate education, without adequate resources, it can be pretty devastating to that child's future. And so I think those are the kinds of things that we often lose sight of, is that it isn't just the circumstances that are dangerous and negatively impact populations, but it's the process of being a refugee and trying to find a home as well that that has lasting effects on young people in particular.
Yeah. No, you're so right. I mean, I think rightly so, because of the pandemic that we are in, and many of us have to work remotely, and you know, there is concern for all of us, but especially for children, right? What this particular life is doing to them. But we are, you know, maybe 7 months in, right? Or 7-8 months in. And if you talk about a refugee child, that child might have been, before it goes to a new destination and find a new home, it might be 5, 10, 15 years that the child has lived in a camp situation. So, yeah. And then it has to, you know, adapt to the new. So it's, so you're definitely right. And I'm not trying to downplay what we are facing here in, you know, mm-hmm. in this particular situation. It is tough. But, you know, if you compare that with the situation of a refugee child, it's something to think about. What drives you in life, Chris?
That's a good question. Obviously, I think I may answer that question differently depending on where I've been in life and what what age I've been at. I think I'm driven more and more by what I can do to impress upon younger people their responsibility and the opportunity that they have to make a difference in the world. I'm at that age or at that point in my career where I'm thinking more about my impact on younger people and them really leaning into their role as leaders. I think I'm past the point where I'm going to radically change the world. If you'd asked me that in my 20s, I might have said something like that. And now I want to make sure that whatever energy, whatever time I have, that it goes into helping to shape and form emerging leaders.
Well, Chris, I would not downplay what you're doing. I think it's working with, you know, a next generation and trying to create an environment where people can flourish and is extremely important. I mean, we always say around, and that's related to our Crop Hunger Walks, it's you know, one step at a time. And I think, so I really applaud on everything that you do. So, many things. And it is not, and maybe in words, it seems to be smaller than what you would have said when you were younger. But I still think it's really, really important. You know, we have a lot of polarization going on, but I think many of us agree on at least on one thing, that 2020 is a pretty rough year in so many aspects. What are some of the things that you worry about? That's the first part of the question. And then the second one, where do you see still a future, a hope? So it's related, of course, always these things. So, yeah. Can you share your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think part of what I understand is happening. Our institutions and our societal institutions, not just religion, government, but a whole host of institutions that we have relied on, are certainly under extreme amounts of stress and pressure to respond and to address the extreme need that we have in the world right now. And so I wonder if the ways in which our institutions are struggling in this age are going to have sort of a lasting impact on their viability. And so that's one thing that worries me. I still am optimistic that we will find ways, as we always have, to strengthen them and to maintain their viability. But that's one thing that worries me. The hope that I have is I because I work with younger people a lot, I've recognized that young people, when they are given the opportunity to lead, lead in different ways. They lead in ways that may not be easily recognizable to me or to people in my generation who are older, but they're leading in ways that that I think are more open to addressing the perspectives and needs of minority or minoritized persons within a group. That is to say, they're no longer focusing on the will of the majority. They're focusing on how does a majority meet the needs of those who are marginalized or disenfranchised. And because I see younger people are oftentimes driven by that, it gives me a tremendous amount of hope that unlike in the past, they're not just trying to take a vote and see, well, where does the majority stand on a particular issue? They're really trying to figure out when they're in charge, how are they going to make sure that all the voices are lifted up in the room in ways that the true needs of those who are marginalized might be addressed. And so that gives me hope that if we as a society can move more in that direction, I tell my students all the time that the origins of our Christian faith are as a minority faith that was concerned about the disenfranchised, and that's been turned on its head when we consider that Christians had a majority role in the U.S. But maybe we're getting back to thinking like we did in the early part of the development of the faith, early history of the faith. That is to say, maybe we're no longer trying to focus on how can we get the most power and the most control. Maybe we're moving toward, with the help of young people, maybe we're moving toward how can we use our power and our control to truly benefit the least of these. And so that does give me hope, and I appreciate that way that young people tend to lean in to their role as leaders.
Well, that is encouraging to hear. One question around that is, so when you talk about this and when you listen and you see the young people that you work with being concerned about it, are they concerned about their own community or about their own country or really about the world as a whole? Because the reason I'm asking is because I was expecting, as a result of this pandemic, that we realized our interconnectedness. And unfortunately, I see a lot of, looking inward as a result, instead of, we need to work together to solve this, So what are you observing?
Yeah, that's a good way to ask the question. But I would say I don't know that we can expect an interconnectedness to be the main motivator for people. I don't know that we ever will see that. There's so much sort of, so-called tribalism to the way that we are formed and shaped as different groups who are making demand on public resources, that some notion of interconnectedness is always going to be challenged by just the notion of tribalism. But what I do think is different now is not so much people trying to work together, but we do see a large number of people who are concerned about working on behalf of. Mm-hmm. And so if we can sort of maximize that to say that there's a lot of people who are willing and interested to work on behalf of the people who truly need it, then we get closer to what our true potential is as a society, as a church, as a community. The interconnectedness, it's always going to be a challenge. We are a nation that is so diverse, talking about the U.S. in particular, that the divide between rural and urban is perhaps greater than it ever has been in much of the history of this country. And so those kinds of divides just exacerbate the existing political divides that we have. And it'll be very difficult to overcome that. But what we can agree upon, I think, in a lot of cases, if we identify people who have extraordinary needs and who are disadvantaged, then we can all kind of agree we need to do something. And maybe that something might not be us doing it together, but us doing it from where we sit and where, or where we stand, and from our location within the wider society.
Okay. Thank you. Any last words for our listeners? You know.
Yeah, I am grateful for just the opportunity to be a part of these kinds of conversations. And I do that. If I could just say one last thing about what I'm encouraged by, is that there's so many people out there who are having these kinds of conversations. That alone is optimistic. The fact that people are talking about these things more and are leaning into having these kinds of conversations says to me that we really are moving in the right direction. We may not see it in some of the rhetoric that we see on social media and on the news and so forth, but I think it's clear to me that something positive is happening, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to contribute to the conversation and to be with you today. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and you always bring a very unique perspective, and both as a human being, but also as being, you know, this teacher that is in the middle of this educational institute where I'm encouraged always by what you see which. Yeah, there is always a bright spot around this, so it's that gives me definitely hope. Yeah, so thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, thank you, Maurice. I appreciate it.
Okay, have a great day.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.